The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
To increase your financial footprint by 20 times and avoid systemic risk while doing it, you're talking about an intergenerational financial coup. Now, the process is slow. On a day-to-day basis, this is not a rewarding process. But in the final analysis, you're compressing time and you're increasing your ability to compound wealth on a nearly incomparable scale.
Now, here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. So tell us, Dave, when we left you last, we were talking about you taking your daughter to a London fashion show. How'd it go?
Well, it was good. I actually had some emailed material from Pete Kendall, who wanted to make sure that I was aware from the socionomic perspective, you know, some trends in fashion and hemlines.
Our guest from last week.
That's right. And they love following and corroborating sort of social trends with mood in the marketplace. And I was fascinated watching this show.
How was your little 7-year-old daughter, Tess?
Oh, it was great. I was whispering in her ear the entire time as we're sitting there on the front row of the catwalk. And I, what do you think of that? Nah, I don't like it. What do you think about this? Oh, it's awful. What do you think about this? I would never wear that. What do you think about that? Oh, that's fantastic.
Isn't it amazing? We were talking about this last night. This little 7-year-old girl you're talking to about adult things, and she wasn't even born, you know, before 2010.
That's right. So, I mean, that was a fun aspect. London, we've done business in London and in Brussels and in Paris and in Hamburg pretty consistently over the last 10 years and even longer, but we actually set up an office in Brussels a number of years ago. And, you know, to maintain business relationships in Europe, at least once a year, I join our team to meet with and kind of continue opening up and maintaining those relationships there in Europe. Just a couple of observations from the trip. London does not appear to be suffering.
Okay, so Brexit is not taking London down the tubes like a lot of people would like to have you believe.
It doesn't really seem like much has changed in terms of business or tourist travel. And if anything, I would say that the currency depreciation in pound sterling has helped attract a fresh flow of visitors to the island.
Well, that needed to happen because when I went to London a few years ago, it was very, very expensive.
It's always expensive. It's just less expensive now than it's been really at any time in my adult life. I experienced the exchange rate back in the 90s when I lived there between 1.5 and 1.6 to the dollar. And then it was considerably, today it's about 1.3. Mm-hmm. Today it's considerably off the levels that we saw circa 2008, 2009. 2007, 8, 9, it was in the range of 1.8. I think at one point it even got up to 2.1 to 1. So $2 exchanged for every £1 meant that everything was doubly expensive. A hamburger, doubly expensive. A Coke, doubly expensive. And London's not a cheap town to begin with. So
you paid double for a single is what you're basically saying.
Right.
Okay, but you don't just, when you go to Europe, you're not just meeting with various people who get us our product. You're also going to refineries and looking at things that are sort of behind the curtain. I'll just give you an example. Platinum, palladium, rhodium. That was part of the trip as well.
Yeah, we're interested in the supply chain and kind of the product that flows from Europe to the United States. And, you know, what I witnessed in 2008 was even with the price of gold dropping off in the midst of that financial crisis, October and November of 2008, we were moving towards limited supplies. And it was this really weird world where you'd think, well, the price must be down because there's too much supply on the market. Mm-hmm. And yet we were limited to 1 kilo bar per client per day.
And
being on a very limited basis, it encouraged me to make sure that we had an adequate supply chain. And a part of that was, as you say, going to refineries in Europe and making sure that we had direct supply, circumventing any middlemen at all. So visiting a refinery on this trip, we were discussing the platinum group metals. It's platinum and palladium. And there was a few helpful points made. Currently, of course, we have a depressed value for platinum, and it ties in some part to overproduction. of platinum, which is motivated by the byproduct extraction. Rhodium is a byproduct, and rhodium was cornered by a hedge fund a little less than a year ago. And so you have industry uses, which they must have it, and at a total supply squeeze. So you've got industries that are industrial uses for rhodium, which are needing to cover those physical ounces, and they can't get it. So it's encouraging an overproduction of platinum. Add to that the current trend for gasoline engines with more of a focus on palladium used in the catalytic converters for those, and you have kind of the double whammy.
This is why these trips are so important. Rhodium has been skyrocketing because of this corner in the market. So obviously people are scrambling to get as much rhodium out of the ground as they can, which produces too much platinum for a short period of time. And then of course you have the other dynamics. I remember a story where you had explorers going to find sunken ships that had sunk when they were carrying gold from South America, you know, hundreds of years ago. And current day explorers would come up and they would look for these gold ships to get the gold. And then later they realized the cannonballs that had been made out of platinum that had been found and just deemed relatively worthless because it was a technological metal that we really didn't discover what it was worth until later. Those cannonballs were worth far more than any of the gold on the ship. So, you know, you look at this and you say, okay, well, why is platinum depressed?
Well, I think a part of it is, you know, the pendulum swings back and forth amongst the consumers between gasoline and diesel engines. And you'll see a big rebound of interest in platinum as it swings back towards diesel engines. And of course, as we mentioned, as that corner is resolved with rhodium. So I guess one of the things that this underscores is how economically sensitive the platinum group metals are. And I mean, we're interested in the platinum group metals, but in our allocations within portfolios, they do make up a much smaller percentage of the total compared to either gold or silver. And it's because they're so economically sensitive, and silver and gold are less so. Silver was still with sitting the middle ground between industrial use and quasi-monetary metal versus gold, which has been, you know, reserves for central banks and a monetary metal for the record of that is about 5,000 years.
Well, and you're really not interested in the price in dollars anyway of any of these. It's the ratio that's important. The ratio of platinum to palladium, gold to silver, that's really where the interest is.
Yeah, well, I mean, it is for the long-term play, and I think it does make sense when you're looking at gold as a stable asset or the precious metals as sort of a portfolio stabilizer there through good times and bad. If you can maximize the value of your allocations by having some dynamic afoot, then I think it does help you along the way. So the ratios are worth playing, particularly if you can do that in tax-deferred accounts. That's, I think, the obvious place. But, you know, modest allocations to the platinum group metals, I think, are sufficient. It's the ratios, as you said. It's not the price, which is the most relevant factor on the platinum group metals.
I remember going to Germany back in the mid-90s, and Brussels, Belgium played a key role in all of Europe as the European community was coming together. It really was the place to be. And I asked you last night if you had tried any of these monk-made Belgian beers, and you said you had.
Brussels is always a favorite place for me to visit. And, you know, you've got the Grand Platz, which is architecture from the 15th century. It's absolutely stunning. It made its way through the war without being destroyed, and a very unique place there in downtown Brussels. But I think Brussels is in a long-term structural decline. And I was surprised to see the number of shops and restaurants closed in the downtown area.
Even though it's sort of the center of the euro.
Yeah, and I think of Brussels as being there in sort of the belly of the eurozone beast. It's the last place to go hungry. It's the last place to run out of funds because it is so central to the eurozone project. But since 2010, I've seen the contrast of vibrant and bustling activity and now things being considerably slower. And certainly, you know, the terrorist activity in 2015 didn't help from the standpoint of, you know, tourist traffic through that city. Because I could tell getting off sort of the tourist beaten track into more of the local areas, it was still okay. It was okay. But they really don't have the flow of people through the city anymore.
That seems like it's awfully different than when your brother Scott was out there setting up the office, the European office, a few years ago.
So the shift that you see in Brussels, it's the same in Paris, and I think you could extrapolate to a few other cities throughout Europe, there now are parts of town where you might consider them no-go zones, unless you are directly tied to the immigrant community. And right, so Scott was in Brussels assisting with setting up our European operations, and while living there, he had a number of conversations with Muslim immigrants, and I remember one conversation in particular, two brothers running a barber shop, and he's just sitting there, and of course, what do you do when you're in a barber shop? You talk and talk, and they were bragging about shifting and being a part of a community that was shifting the balance of European power within a generation. It was their belief that they could do this simply by having multiple wives and having countless children with each of those wives. And I'm not trying to poison a well or create unnecessary controversy. Some of this boils down to numbers, and you can see the tension and stress growing within Europe. As you know, Europe has a number of issues that it has to deal with, not the least of which is that they don't have a unified fiscal policy, while they do have a unified monetary policy. And yet you've got, you know, diverse interests in every country. Of course, you get individual and diverse interests within each city, within each country. So it gets very complex. But at the heart of the European crisis is this identity crisis. And I think there's been a growing trend, sort of a gutless unwillingness to keep common sense in the political equation. You want to be ultra sensitive to all parties. I think whether you're looking at the US as a melting pot or Europe as a melting pot, it's not racist and it's not bigoted to encourage cultural integration. If you want to move someplace, if you want to move in, great, learn the language, appreciate the culture, and things go very well for you. Certainly that has been, as an immigrant country, which we are here in America, that's part and parcel to what we reflect. And, you know, if you lack a sense of place, and I think this is really back to that European identity crisis, if you lack a sense of place, if you lack a sense of self and identity, you bring in a strong-willed personality and you'll simply get rolled over. And Europe is getting rolled over. Brussels is a microcosm of that change.
And you ended up shutting down the office, I think, partially because of that.
Yeah, well, we've shut down our office there because we can feel the crisis dynamics bubbling up again. And, you know, whether it's Italy here in the last week or so, and the debt markets and the bank shares in Italy, there's other reasons why we have concerns about the Eurozone project. But there's a real change afoot in terms of how it's managed.
Last week when we were talking to the Elliott Wave team, they were saying that this isn't just a localized super cycle dynamic. They said that this is a worldwide kind of phenomenon. You know, we need to talk about some of the Italian debt crumbling here and a few other discussions about Europe. So last week with the Elliott Wave team, we discussed a potential top in the, you know, super cycle, what they were talking about, super cycle dynamics. And they talked about all-time highs, certain all-time highs hitting all at the same time. And we have another all-time high right now. You're talking about ratios.
Right. For your consideration, I mean, this is not really a timing mechanism type thing, something that you use to trade the market, but it does support the idea that we are at a significant top. Look at household net worth. Compare that to your GDP figures. This gives a comparison between the overall economy and the value of the assets which are owned by the U.S. citizens.
And nobody's going to argue about having a high household net worth. I mean, that sounds great, but what we have to do is compare it to what is our actual productivity? What's supporting it?
Right. So when the financial assets and the real estate assets, those two components, financial assets and real estate, they figure into your net worth figures, take out debt, of course. When it reaches extremes relative to the underlying economy and the actual activity which is occurring in the economy, at a minimum, you can expect a period of sort of digestion where, you know, prices are not necessarily on the increase and maybe GDP is catching up to where prices have gone. But it's quite typical that as you reach new highs, particularly in this statistic, what follows is a significant period of consolidation, of loss. Occasionally, in nominal terms, you see, you know, a precipitous decline in prices. And occasionally, you've got the pain which shows up in real terms. This was sort of that period of the late 60s to early 80s, where the price of stocks did not decline very considerably, but inflation increased each year as time went on, and it began to wreak the same kind of havoc in real terms that a nominal price decline would have.
Yeah, so you can either lose it with a crash in prices, or you can narrow that ratio. Actually, what would be good would be if the GDP rose. But let's go ahead and look and contrast that with these periods of time that you're talking about. I mean, household net worth right now sits at what relative to GDP?
Yeah, household net worth sits at 522% of GDP currently. Better numbers have never been seen.
If you want to call it better. Higher numbers
have never been seen. Okay, so in the 70s, just for reference, in the 70s, it was 342% at its best, at its very best. In the 80s, it stretched a little bit further to 378% mm-hmm. at its best. At the market peak in 1999, it got to levels had never seen before, 447% of GDP.
Before the tech stock bubble popped.
Yep. And obviously there is some mean reversion, which is a nice way of saying.
Real mean.
Real mean.
Yeah.
Exactly. 2007, 473% of net worth GDP.
Before a real mean reversion again.
Another mean reversion, nasty one. The contrast between these numbers currently and those of the past is the financial asset piece, so you're talking stocks and bonds, it's grown far more than the real estate piece. I don't have to tell you the potential for faster declines in the financial markets. The flow's faster, the flows are larger. You know, think about how long it takes to transact on real estate. And you usually have homeowners who, even if their neighbor's house sells for $50,000 less or $250,000 less, they believe that it was an anomaly. Mm-hmm. And they believe that they can ask what they want to ask and are likely to get the price that they want for their house. So there's a slower process for price adjustment within the real estate market compared to stocks and bonds, which is why it tends to be nastier. And lo and behold, the largest components of that 522% of GDP to household net worth, the largest growth component has been there in the financial market, stocks and bonds. So let's go back to the discussion last week with Pete and Steve. The relative value between stocks and gold is compelling. You've got the Dow gold ratio sitting right around 22 to 1. It says two things to me. Number one, it says that on a cyclical basis, gold is cheap. And number two, it says that on a secular trends basis, gold is strong. Well, why would I say that? You know, it's dropped from 1900 to 1200. How can gold be strong? Well, on a secular trend basis, keep in mind that gold has still outperformed the stock market over the last 18 years significantly.
Yeah, significantly. Yeah, because we got to 43 to 1 in the year 2000.
That's right. Now we're at 22 to 1.
Right.
And we've maintained the majority of the gains from that 2000 to 2012 period. We've maintained the majority of those gains.
And so for the listener who's new to this, what we're basically saying is the stock market, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, was worth 43 ounces of gold in the year 2000. Now it's dropped to 22. And typically, when you go through the full cycle, it'll drop to 3, maybe 2 to 1.
And maybe even 1 to 1. So the bull market in gold started the current trend at a relative ratio to stocks, 43 to 1. 22 to 1 signifies the gold market has still outperformed stocks.
Yes.
From then to now, even with stocks at record highs, when you price the stock market in real money terms, it's only half of its former value. Isn't that amazing?
That's amazing. So how probable is it that we get down to that 5, 4, 3, 2 to 1?
I think 5, 4, and 3, highly probable. 1 to 1 is a real possibility. Both of those would happen over the next 3 to 5 years. And our point last week was this. To increase your financial footprint by 20x, to increase your financial footprint by 20 times and avoid systemic risk while doing it. I talked about MF Global when my wall of shame at moments. And sidestepping the traditional bank savings programs, which pay you nothing. You're talking about an intergenerational financial coup. Now, the process is slow. On a day-to-day basis, this is not a rewarding process, but in the final analysis, you're compressing time and you're increasing your ability to compound wealth on a nearly incomparable scale.
Well, and it takes a discipline to look at something a different way. You know, I was hearing somebody talk about a movie called Vantage Point the other night with Dennis Quaid, and it's about an assassination attempt on a president. And there are 7 different witnesses, and they all tell a little bit of a different story, but the truth comes out through those different witnesses of what actually happened, different vantage points. If a person can change their vantage point and start measuring things relative to ounces of gold instead of dollars, it's that 20-fold return that you're looking at. If you cannot understand that, you miss the gain.
In my lifetime, I will have gone from entering the gold market with a sizable investment at around 40 to 1, and I will exit many of those ounces at closer to a 1-to-1 ratio.
Which is like a 40-fold return on your gains.
Within an adult lifetime, just one adult lifetime, to have seen a 20, 30, or 40-fold increase. I mean, keep in mind, when you're doing the math and compounding wealth on a, you know, kind of using the rule of 72 basis, and you're compounding your wealth at, say, 10% a year, you're doubling every 7 years. So you've doubled again. So you might have a 3 or 4-fold return over a 30 to 40 year period. We're talking about a 40-fold return over a comparable time frame, and it is painstaking, can be ugly, totally boring, and oftentimes demoralizing. The question is, do you have your eyes on the prize? And I think history suggests that we are going to see a 3-to-1 ratio on the basis of economics and finance. The only time that you see a 1-to-1 ratio Dow Gold is when you have a financial market catastrophe overlaid with geopolitical catastrophe. Mm-hmm. And with that geopolitical catastrophe, 1-to-1, it's happened multiple times in the last 100 years.
Well, and you have preached, make sure that you figure out what your exit strategy is. When you buy your gold, understand the exit strategy. Now, I want to shift back to stocks just for a moment, because we oftentimes look at the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which is continually changing. In fact, we've talked for years about how there was just one stock left, General Electric, from the original Dow, and that dropped off in June. Okay, so we no longer have any of the original stocks from the Dow when it first started back in 1896. But probably another way, speaking of vantage points, to look at the stock market is to look at the composite index. In other words, look at a much broader index and say, what's really happening to the composite versus, say, just a very small grouping of stocks?
Well, and before we go to the New York Stock Exchange composite, GE has always been one of my favorite examples, because when I was working at Morgan Stanley, GE shares had just sold off like $5 off of their peak. They'd gone from 60 to 55. And, you know, they're in Pasadena, California, blue blood families like you can't believe. And there at the Ritz-Carlton, they flew in the CFO from GE, and he gave a presentation to kind of calm the nerves of investors who
were
thinking,
because it had fallen $5.
Well, and maybe this was a peak, and maybe they wanted to change allocations, and they just needed some reassurance that this was not a big deal. So it was off $5. It was off $7, but in a short period of time, and they were a little nervous. $30,000 at the time would have bought you 500 shares of GE, or 100 ounces of gold. Now, this is just an example of the kind of purchasing power gain that you can have when you prioritize one asset class versus another for a certain period of time. I've chosen gold over this period of time. Someday, I'll prioritize GE or comparable shares to it.
So $30,000 would buy 500 shares of GE or 100 ounces of gold. This was back in the year 2000, 2001.
Okay. So today, those 500 shares of GE are worth about $6,000, and your 100 ounces of gold are worth about $120,000. So you're up more than fourfold in your metals, and you've lost a huge amount of money in the GE shares.
Right.
So the point is, at some point, to make a lateral move out of your metals and back into GE means that you don't have the original proposition of 500 shares, but maybe it's 5,000 shares, or maybe it's 50,000 shares.
Sure.
I mean, all of a sudden, your financial footprint is increased considerably, and there's no amount of reinvesting dividends on 500 shares that will ever get you to 50,000 shares.
You've gone from Tiny Tim to Bigfoot, is what you've done. I mean, it's just a dramatic difference in your footprint.
But these are things that take time and patience, something that most investors don't really prioritize. They want to know what the markets have done for them today.
In dollars. Yep.
And these are, again, relative terms are in many senses more important than nominal terms. So you mentioned the New York Stock Exchange Composite Index. It captures the broadest cross-section of stocks, and it sends a very clear message. It clearly depicts the bull market rally hit its peak in January. That was not only the peak in price, but also it was a peak in the number of companies that were hitting new highs. Since then, the number of new highs versus new lows creates a compelling case for the best already being behind us and the current uptrend in price being really on borrowed time and on borrowed energy. Mm. Because you don't have the vast majority of, even though we have new highs, the Dow and the S&P and NASDAQ, whatever, you don't have the number of companies setting new highs. It's very narrow in terms of the investor interest, and you're seeing greater and greater concentrations in just a few names. You can go back in time. Anytime this has happened, there's been carnage that followed. And pick your time frame. The Nifty 50, the NASDAQ stocks of the 2000 period, right. When there's a concentration of interest in just a few shares, those are usually the shares that get pummeled the worst.
I remember the late 90s. It was, don't bother me with the facts. Just tell me what Cisco's done. Just tell me what Pets.com has done.
Sun Microsystems.
Like Bill King says, you know, how'd that turn out for you?
Right.
Not real good. Okay, so let's go across the pond again, because we've talked about interest rates skyrocketing in some of these countries like Turkey, Argentina, Brazil. But now we've got Italy. This has been a fly in the ointment for a while. Italy and Spain have been sitting out there waiting to happen. Is it happening?
Yeah. Well, the Italian bonds sold off sharply last week. Italian bank stocks were notably weaker. And what the markets were reacting to is the new government's budget for 2019. It's going to leave about a 2.4% deficit versus their economy, versus GDP, and what was on tap, what was expected, was 2%.
Well, the person listening has got to be saying, how does that matter?
How does 0.4% matter?
Exactly.
Well, it's a frail system.
Well, where's the United States? I mean, we're in worse shape, are we not?
I loved Doug Nolan's comments this last week. He's just wondering why there's such a forceful reaction in Italy when we're coming up on 5% here in the United States, where our deficit is a real number. It's a far bigger number than what we have in Italy. And I mean, obviously, the advantage that we have is we're the world's reserve currency, and there's a few things that we get away with because we can push our weight around.
Exorbitant privilege.
But we get to keep that privilege as long as we're willing to push our weight around. Not always appreciated, not always easy to maintain, but that's where we are today. European worries, you know, they pushed the euro lower last week, the U.S. dollar higher. And of course, as the dollar heads higher on any given week, there's further consequences for the emerging markets and emerging market currencies. So 2 weeks ago, you had Argentina's currency, it increased over 7%. Then the dollar bumps up last week, and lo and behold, the Argentine currency's down 9.9%.
That's a little bit of volatility. I mean, we're not seeing a lot of volatility in our stock market, so I guess we can see it in currency.
That's a lot of volatility.
Yeah.
Up 7% 1 week, down almost 10 the next. Also of note, was the strong quarterly finish for most of your U.S. indexes. Just finished the quarter, and I think there was an obvious exception, which was U.S. banks finishing Friday down 4.7% just last week, closing out the quarter on a low note. So I like watching the financials. The financials can often lead the markets on the upside and the downside. Financials and small caps are two places that sometimes you get some signaling as to the market heading significantly higher or significantly lower. So we'll continue to watch the bank stocks and see if they're beginning a longer-term trend, presaging something for the rest of the markets.
So you were talking about Brussels, Belgium, which used to be sort of the gemstone of the euro, being a signal that it may be waning. Is the Italian sovereign debt, is that also showing us that this euro project is starting to crumble?
Well, I mean, it underscores political dysfunction in Italy, and the problems the Eurozone faces in the years ahead will be problems of survival. You know, because the populist movement, the five-star movement, it's just one iteration where you have national interests trumping European interests, no pun intended. It's very difficult to imagine the next crisis globally not destroying a massive amount of wealth there in Europe, particularly in the sovereign debt markets. This is where you see the absurd on display almost every day, where most of your government debt in Europe is still priced to yield a fraction of what the U.S. 10-year is today. Last week, we got over 3%, 3.09% on the 10-year treasury. And relatively speaking, you're talking about micro yields in Europe, which really tells you the footprint of the European Central Bank. Those are not sustainable markets. And ultimately, there's going to be hemorrhaging in investor pockets if they own sovereign debt in Europe.
So being in London last week, you probably sensed that it was wise. There was a wisdom to Brexit breaking away from what could be a very strong deflationary trend in Europe.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. In the fullness of time, I think Brexit will be viewed as the choice that separated the UK from Eurozone implosion, something that gave them some protection from it. As the Eurozone was circling the drain, they were able to extricate themselves at the 11th hour and 59th minute. Now, that's not the way it's seen. It's still a very contentious issue in the City of London, particularly in the City of London, which, I mean, London proper was the only place in Europe where you had a strong stay vote. It was the rest of England, which was, what's the benefit?
That happens here in America all the time. It's the cities that stay on the liberal socialist side.
Right.
And the country, the people who are actually out there, hey, you know, if the farm doesn't grow, it doesn't grow. You know, you
right.
earn it out there.
No, that's right. Socialist benefits accrue in clusters of people.
That's right.
Where the most people are there, and no surprise there.
That was George Washington's warning. Do you remember that? George Washington said he sees the future of America in the West because he sees the East turning back towards Europe.
And again, I mean, I know there's been a lot of argumentation, debate about the way we have our system set up here with the Electoral College, but this is why, because you'd have three cities in the United States
controlling the whole vote,
which would control the entire vote versus being a representation of a whole cross-section of culture and society. So, you know, in the markets, this last week we saw silver outperforming gold, moving higher on a quicker basis than gold, kind of diverging, if you will. Crude, it finished the quarter at 21% gain for the year so far. Natural gas has just peaked its head into the positive territory. It has suffered losses most of the year so far. Copper's still under pressure. Copper's down 15% year to date, which people should remember. Copper is sort of a bellwether for economic activity. It flies in the face of what we know from economic statistics here in the United States, and is probably a clear picture into the trajectory of global economic activity and growth for 2019.
Well, I know for commodities, people like to call copper the doctor, Dr. Copper, but actually another doctor that you could look at, another bellwether, is how much does somebody have to pay to actually buy a house? Because nobody actually buys houses anymore. They just borrow to buy a house. I mean, there are very few people who can do that.
The first house that we purchased, we financed at 6.75%. And by the time we moved to Colorado and were able to refinance our house here in Colorado, we financed at about under 3.25%.
You get an awful lot more house.
You get an awful lot more house. And now we're coming up on that 5% number, 4.72, up nearly 0.75 point year over year. There is a point where the price of single family homes are no longer affordable, and it drives people into the rental market. And, you know, we look at the inflation in rents, and you see that up again in the last monthly reading, up over 2%. And home builders really aren't doing much to solve the supply issue.
Hmm.
If you look at their share prices, they've continued to march lower along with copper. Take Lennar, for instance. It's no higher today than it was in 2015. Stocks all across the board at higher levels, right? Not the home builders. And again, the home builders and autos, and these should be giving you an indication of what's happening on a broad basis within the economy. And they're suggesting that at best we have mixed signals. We have some official statistics and certainly the confidence indicators, which are lagging indicators, not leading indicators, say that it really hasn't been better in the last 10 or 15 years.
Well, when we were in the mid-2000s, we started warning people about the rising prices of real estate getting way beyond what they could sustain. And I remember your dad even sent out a CD to all of her clients saying, you know, get out of real estate. I think this was 2005. I just listened to it the other day. It was really amazing. But, and then of course we had the crash. Last time we had our financial crash that was led by real estate, the banks were the ones that were exposed. They held the debt. Now, is that still the case or has that burden shifted?
Good question. I one of the reasons I like to travel is because I get a lot of reading done. I got two books read on the way over and the way back, and we'll be talking with one of those authors here at the end of the month. Very excited about those conversations, but also reading the Financial Times this past week while on the road. John Authors, Brooke Fox, two writers pointed out that the speculative excesses of that period, 2008 and 2009, they've just migrated. They haven't gone away. You now have pension funds, which hold the risk that banks once did.
Okay, so that answers the question. Banks held the risk before. Now you've got people who are counting on this for retirement.
Pension funds and savers seeking higher yield, and by necessity, in a low-rate environment from 2008-09 to the present, they've been shifting their risk profile, to include high-yield bonds, to include hedge funds, to include private equity. And all of these products have leverage built into their structures, and that leverage is not very well accounted for in the aggregate. So we probably have more leverage in the system than even groups like the BIS would necessarily account for. So in essence, these writers were suggesting that the migration of risk has gone from shareholders to savers. What you risk now is a social crisis in the next financial downturn.
Boy, could you imagine? I mean, already the temperature's high with all the things going on in Washington right now. Could you imagine if we actually had a financial downturn?
Right. So the political backdrop, and we know that it's contentious here in the United States, but it's also contentious in Europe. And I don't know that they can take much more pressure. So a few days later, the Financial Times commented on the Bank of International Settlements, the BIS, their assessment of debt growth since the financial crisis. And the move has been away from bank-funded debts towards bond issuance instead. So the big substitution, no longer bank loans, now it's bonds, which is interesting because, as we've discussed previously, a lot of that funding has focused on U.S. dollar-denominated bonds and, to a slightly lesser degree, euro-denominated bonds with some cross-exchange rate risk. So debt securities, we're talking bonds, now make up 57% of total international credit, according to the Bank of International Settlements, up from 48% just a few years ago. You get bank debt, which is being displaced by, again, the financial market bond issuance. And I think what's really important to note is that when you're bailing out institutions, it's far easier to step in and define what the terms will be for that particular institution. In some instances, like we remember Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, that was sort of like a weekend shotgun wedding, right? It was like, we've just introduced you, you will be happy together, and you will take these losses, and you will now properly live under the same household. That was Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, and a whole bunch of other forced marriages in the last financial crisis.
But you could isolate that. Now, how do coordinate an intervention when you've got it all spread out in bonds, in pension funds that are holding it?
Exactly. Now you're talking about sifting through which creditors and which investors, which savers will be helped. The idea of a coordinated intervention in the next financial crisis is pretty hard to fathom. And I think the will of the people, if you're looking at taking the temperature here in the United States as well as in Europe, the will of the people is not behind helping other countries and getting into the business of other geographies. It's just harder to pull off a humanitarian effort when lots of countries are in crisis and they really have to or have the inclination to take care of themselves first.
You know, something that caused or at least was a symptom of the last debt crisis was this debt securitization. Okay, there was this opacity to understanding what actually was the problem. You know, you were talking about how it's hard to actually see where the leverage is because it's just sort of spread out.
Well, and the place where you can see it is with the sovereigns. You know, so in the corporate structure, and yes, we have the debt securitization craze, it's back. One of the lingering signs of the past crisis is the total stock of sovereign debt because it's off the scales and you can see that. I don't disagree. I don't disagree with the Precter crew that deflation is coming.
Right.
I just see it as selectively hitting asset classes. So we were talking about the Italian debt markets. You can see an evaporation of wealth in a quarantined and isolated area, and it is absolutely deflationary, not necessarily systemic wide, but on a case by case. I mean, it almost reminds me of Ebola. If you can control and quarantine it, it's going to selectively hit a population group. This morning, I enjoyed reading Robert Prechter's most recent October letter. And he took a very balanced view where, yeah, you want to own treasuries. And yeah, there's going to be a crisis of confidence in the debt markets such that interest rates should rise. So if you're going to own treasuries, make sure you own floating rate notes and balance that exposure with gold. And I thought, wait a minute. Was he listening to last week's
I was going to say, isn't that exactly what we talked about last week? You know, I was thinking of the movie The Big Short, the movie about the 2008 crisis and how there were selective people who became very, very wealthy betting on the short side of this market. And it seems that we may have another movie in the making.
Well, and I mean, I think you know, again, when I think of deflation as hitting select asset classes and not sort of a broad universal deflation, what is not selective at all, but is very sort of a broad universal blanket thrown over all the financial markets globally, is an inflation bias from the central bank community.
Right. Well, who's at benefit? The central bank community loves inflation. Well, they don't hate it.
Right. Because if you look at the debt markets, you see increasing quantities of debt, which are not a big deal if you can inflate the pressure of that debt away. So inflation has always been the friend of an overleveraged or over indebted actor. And here you've got the sovereigns, which are amongst the worst offenders in that category today. And then they happen to control the monetary policy mechanisms, which promote inflation. So the gradual lifting of the debt burden via a long and very tedious process of currency devaluation, that is who they are. That's how they operate. Yeah. It's one of the most predictable things that you have in play. And yes, you'll have select deflations in select asset classes, but inflation is coming. And yes, in that broader context, you can expect to see sector and individual asset class price implosion, which is, again, what we talked about last week, deflating of price.
And you're talking about more rapid inflation is coming, because I went back and looked at the price of a loaf of bread in 1987 when I started working here, Dave, and it was 80 cents. Okay, so 350, 365 loaves of bread, if you ate a loaf of bread a day, would be about $300 back then. Well, guess what gold was? It was $300. And, you know, I remember your dad telling this story, you know, 100 years before. A loaf of bread was 6 cents and gold was $21. Well, that's still about a loaf of bread a day. Today, a loaf of bread is in the mid $3 range. Okay. It's not 80 cents anymore, just in the years that I've been here. And in the years that I've been here, no one would say we had high inflation. Yet a loaf of bread has gone from 80 cents to the mid threes, and an ounce of gold has gone from 300 to 1200.
Still covers your loaf of bread a day.
So we've had inflation. Gold has protected me against inflation. But going forward, if that inflation increases, could we have another late 1970s event like what your dad went through when the company first started?
Well, this is one of the aspects that I want to talk about with our guest at the end of the month, Ed Easterling. He's got an interesting view on the role that inflation plays. And it's actually, his point is more profound than inflation versus deflation. He's saying that any move away from price stability is negative for asset prices. So stocks and bonds are vulnerable if you have a dramatic move away from price stability. Doesn't matter if it's inflation or deflation. So the question is, what has the trend been and what are the likelihoods? What are the probabilities of trend mean reversion or what, moving in the opposite direction? And it'll be an interesting conversation because he's very keen on secular trends in the stock market and bond market. And sort of in complement to what we talked about last week with the Prechter team, fundamentals matter. To him, you cannot ignore fundamentals. Fundamentals ultimately determine the course of the market.
One of the magazines that your dad got you reading when you were little was Barron's magazine. You saw your dad reading it. We've had guests on who were key editors.
Alan Abelson, for years.
Yeah, Alan Abelson. But last week, Barron's also mentioned the fact that inflation, very conservative Barron's, is saying, could we possibly be looking at higher inflation?
Yeah, the gold market has been too neglected of late. And I can hear the question from one of you out there as a listener. If Barron's is giving a plug for gold, is that ever a good thing?
Good point.
I would say that the environment is hardly one of bullish momentum.
Right.
In fact, you've got Vanguard, which is dumping its only precious metals fund here in recent weeks, which is far more suggestive of reaching a low. So I would look at the Barron's article not as, a tip-off of gold heading lower, but rather representing a contrarian possibility, not a full-fledged endorsement.
Yeah, and you mentioned Vanguard dumping its only precious metals fund. Vanguard really is the vanguard in this whole passive investing mentality where you really don't need a manager anymore. Just put it in and it works.
And it'll work until it doesn't.
Right.
It'll work until it doesn't. Bank of America Merrill Lynch released a paper here in recent weeks ranking countries by the quality of their domestic finances. And for the purpose of the comparison, they combined the current account deficits and the budget deficits as a percentage of 2019 GDP.
Basically just trying to test the health of these various countries.
Yep. So where do you think the U.S. lands out of the 45 countries they were outlining?
You mean the greatest economy in the world, the United States, with the reserve currency, with Trump? I mean, how are we? How are we doing?
Fifth from last.
Out of 45 countries, we're fifth from the last.
We maintained a lead over Argentina, Turkey, Brazil and Pakistan. And of course, this is because our current account deficit and our budget deficits are just wacky. So we have something that those other countries don't have. We have the reserve currency status.
And the military to enforce it.
Well, that's right. Like I said earlier, because we get to push our weight around. The only way you get to push your weight around is with healthy contracts to Lockheed Martin and other arms manufacturers, which make sure you have the best, the latest, the greatest.
We're in the Navy now.
Well, next week I'm going to meet with Jim Grant for his company's 35th anniversary celebration.
Interest rate observer.
Right.
Jim Grant, interest rate observer, 35 years writing the paper.
And he asked the question recently, we wonder if the demand for dollars is infinitely sustainable at current interest rates, at current exchange rates, and with the current state of geopolitical play. And he went on to say, there's a silent party at the monetary policy table. He or she is the person who elects to hold dollars or instead chooses euros, yen, Singapore dollars, or gold. And his point was really towards this end. Today, the dollar is hands down the currency of choice. But other considerations may weigh in the scales tomorrow.
Dave, do you remember from the 70s all the way until the tech stock bubble popped, where the United States actually had to pay people interest to hold dollars? Do you remember that?
Yeah. Well, Fed funds rate averaged 7% through that period, probably from 1970 to the year 2000. Most of my adult life, the average Fed funds rate was 7%. And now we get a quarter of a point tick up last week, which is great. You know, that's the first interest rate move we've had in this whole tightening cycle that has brought the rate of interest above the inflation rate. So arguably, and I've thought about this while I was in Europe, is this really where we initiate the three steps and then a stumble? Because up to this point, it's been less accommodative monetary policy, but by no means restrictive. When you are now seeing an interest rate that's above the rate of inflation, could you argue that we now have a restrictive monetary policy? This was the first of three restrictive monetary policies have we initiated our three steps and then a stumble. Who knows what the threshold is, but there is going to be a point at which asset prices recalibrate. And that's also something that I want to talk with Ed Easterling about, because interest rates are a factor. Inflation is a factor. There's some really significant elements here, which are going to determine the course of investor returns over the next decade.
And, you know, there is a whiff in the wind that the market might be too high. When you look at the executives who run those companies, not actually holding the shares of their own companies, even though they're using company assets to buy back shares en masse, you know what it reminds me of? When you've got an executive selling shares and then taking the same assets of the company and buying back shares that come back onto the books of the company, it reminds me of an analogy. Let's just say you walked into a McDonald's and Ronald McDonald was walking out and you just followed Ronald McDonald. Okay, now Ronald's there to sell you burgers, tell you that the burgers are the greatest thing.
but he goes
next door to the salad bar, okay, and he's eating salad and it's like, what does Ronald McDonald know that
about
I
those
don't?
Hamburgers.
Yeah, and you've got these executives, these guys are selling their own shares at, I think, record levels.
Well, so certainly August was record. And the Wall Street Journal was talking about the record number of share buybacks, right? And we're still on track. You know, $189 billion here recently keeps us on track for the $800 billion to $1 trillion end of year finale. And of course, if you're buying back all those shares, you're boosting your earnings per share.
Well, and the price of the shares. I mean, that does push the market up too.
But yeah, I mean, you're limiting the supply, bumping up the price. The improvement in earnings per share, remember that compensation packages are triggered off of earnings improvements, right? So you get an earnings improvement off of the share buybacks, which triggers compensation packages for the executives. And lo and behold, executives are doing the opposite with their own shares versus what they're doing with company capital.
So they boost the compensation package, they get shares, they sell their shares, and they buy back more with company assets and boost their compensation package.
Well,
they do this over and over. That's what Smithers was talking about.
Right. So September, they unloaded $5.7 billion in shares, according to TrimTabs. Great organization. They do some great research. $5.7 billion in insider selling, according to TrimTabs. That's their own shares. They're quietly slipping to the exits as the crowd enthusiasm for new high prices is sucking in the average investor into the indexes.
Ronald is going to the salad bar.
Yeah, but August was even worse. August was at a 10-year record, $10.3 billion in insider selling. I think it's worth lingering on that question. Buybacks and insider selling, how do you translate the difference?
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or you can call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.